So let me say again that this is the final Sunday of the Christian liturgical calendar, and again, we kick off a new year next week with the first Sunday of Advent. Today, again, is also known in many church traditions as Christ the King or Reign of Christ Sunday, an observance instituted in 1925 by the Roman Catholic Church and since adopted by many other traditions since, including the Methodists. But I gotta tell you, personally, I don't buy it. I mean, I don't buy, or at least I don't embrace any notion of Jesus as King. For starters, because I don't believe that Jesus understood himself that way. And more importantly, because the so-called kingdom of God to which his entire life and ministry pointed was and is thoroughly antithetical to the inherent nature of hierarchical, authoritarian kingdoms and monarchies. As much as the church and the Christian tradition from its earliest days has proclaimed its Christ as King and even King of Kings, such a title distorts what Jesus actually said about himself and about God's reign in the Gospels. In fact, as we see in this morning's reading from the Gospel of John, Jesus refuses to accept the title of king in his interaction with Roman authorities after he is arrested and standing trial. Answering first to the high priest, the Jewish religious authority, Jesus is brought before Pilate to answer to the Roman political authority. And Pilate asks him straight up, as you heard me just read, "Are you the king of the Jews? Are you the king of the Jews?" Or probably better translated, "Are you the king of the Judeans?" Referring to the province in which Jesus and his fellow compatriots lived under Roman occupation. John's gospel, much more than the three synoptic gospels, emphasizes this political charge brought against Jesus. Sedition, right? Sedition that he claims to be a king in clear defiance of the Roman emperor's authority. Only Jesus never actually makes that claim about himself, including in this exchange with Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" Pilate asks. And after Jesus clarifies that Pilate's question is prompted by others' claims against him, Pilate asks him what he has done to warrant this charge. "My kingdom is not from this world. If my kingdom were from this world, my followers would be fighting to keep me from being handed over. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." In other words, Jesus confirms what we already know to be true, that the trumped-up charge of sedition is based on his actions, his teaching about and organizing on behalf of the kingdom of God, what we know to be a radical vision of another way, a decidedly non-violent way, as he indicates in this response, a way that is necessarily threatening to the worldly power of existing religious, political, and economic structures, and increasingly perceived as threatening because of his growing popularity, people power. And remember that this is nothing new for Jesus. He's perceived as a threat from the moment he's born into the world. When the Magi, the wise men, if you remember the story, approach King Herod, who had himself received the title King of the Jews from the Emperor Augustus, they are trying to locate the child who they claim has been born King of the Jews. Herod feels the threat to his authority and power, even in the form of a newborn child, and does what kingdoms of this world often do when they feel threatened. He resorts to violent suppression. In his case, immediately ordering the execution of all male children under the age of 2 in and around Bethlehem to try to literally eliminate any possibility of another way. And so Pilate asked Jesus again, "So you are a king? Or maybe, so you are a king? You say that I am a king. You say that I am a king." It's true that Jesus doesn't deny the charge, but he does not make any such claim about himself. The three other gospel accounts in Matthew, Mark, and Luke strike a similar tone, though more succinctly. "You say so. You say so." And in those accounts, when he is further accused by the authorities, he simply refuses to answer. "You say that I am a king," Jesus responds. And he goes on, "For this I was born, for this I came into the world." This, right? Understand this, not referring back to being a king, but to what he says next. To testify to the truth. To testify to the truth. And note that Jesus says elsewhere in John that he came that they may have life and have it abundantly. Unlike the, quote, thief who comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Jesus came into the world to share the truth at the heart of his radical vision, a vision of abundant life for all that defines God's kingdom, or what we at Calvary, I say kingdom, but or what we at Calvary refer to as God's kingdom, to emphasize its egalitarian nature. Again, neither hierarchical or patriarchal, because language matters. It matters. So we say kingdom to emphasize what the kingdom is about. When the church describes and understands Jesus as king, and if you identify Jesus that way, this is meant as no offense, but I believe it makes the full extent, it misses the full extent of that truth. And the full impact of that vision when we think of Jesus as king. The Jesus who was born in a stable and made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem on a donkey, lifted up by those around him who followed him as the long anticipated healer king. He makes a mockery of worldly kingdoms. Jesus is the anti-king. The title does not fit, right? We have words that try to capture the essence of Jesus and, for that matter, the essence of God, but words don't cut it. It doesn't fit. Jesus was not interested in being part of such systems of domination. He was not interested in replicating those systems of oppression. He was interested in revolution, a revolution of values turning prevailing systems and structures of power on their heads. In suggesting, for example, that in God's kingdom the first will be last and the last will be first, Jesus is not proposing mere reforms to existing religious, political, and economic systems. He's calling for wholesale change, turning those unjust systems completely on their heads, upside down, or as we explored and considered last week, right side up. New wineskins for new wine. But of course, a system where the first become last and the last become first still means there are those who are last. And a system where the rich become poor and the poor become rich still means there are those who are poor. It's still an unjust kingdom, not beloved community. Jesus is deliberately dramatic to make the point about how radically things have to change, because his life and ministry clearly and consistently points to a kingdom where there are no first and last, where there are no rich and poor. In fact, as we considered a while back, there is no place for those who are rich, as the rich young ruler learned so painfully. In God's kingdom, everyone and everything has enough. There are variations of the same basic story of the disciples arguing about who among them is the greatest. In Matthew, it's the mother of James and John who asked Jesus on her son's behalf if they might sit at his right and left hand in his kingdom, in his glory. And Mark, James, and John make the request themselves. And in Luke, the disciples are all arguing. But the response from Jesus is the same. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. And those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? But I am among you as one who serves. Obviously, right? Obviously, we know the answer for the kingdoms of this world. It's the one at the table, but Jesus is different. And he goes on then, this is in Luke chapter 22, to confer. The translation in the New Revised Standard Version is to confer on the disciples, on his followers, the kingdom, the very kingdom that God has conferred on him. And such a kingdom, he says elsewhere, belongs instead not to the mighty and powerful, not to the kings and the monarchs, not to the emperors, but to the poor in spirit. It belongs to those who mourn. It belongs to the meek, to those who hunger and thirst for righteousness and who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. It belongs to those who are merciful, to those who are pure in heart, to those who are peacemakers, to little children, he says, to those who are salt of the earth and light of the world, to those who are born again, born of water and the Spirit, who see with new eyes and hear with new ears and love with new hearts. A kingdom of divine love marked by justice, by peace and nonviolence, by radical inclusion and equity is not from this world. Jesus says God's kingdom of love is within us. If we make space for it, and the kingdom that begins within each of us as mustard seeds will grow surely like leaven in bread. And for that reason, Jesus also says the kingdom is at hand. The kingdom is near, nearer than you think, nearer than we think. So seek God's kingdom first above all else, and all these things will be given to you as well. Now is the time, friends. Call it a New Year's resolution, if that helps, or call it a New Year's revolution, that we may commit and recommit ourselves to the work of kingdom building, following Jesus, the anti-king, making way for another way, where divine love reigns supreme. May it be so.